Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is my favorite science writer, Philip Manning, who is an award-winning author of wonderful books about nature and science, lives in Chapel Hill. You are famous, Phil Manning, most of all because you live in a famous house.
I fear that's true.
Which is, and there's stuff happening about
Our house has a big plaque on the front of it. And the plaque has three names on it, none of which are mine. But the last one is Betty Smith, of course, who wrote A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
And she wrote a book
who has outsold everything I've ever dreamed of.
Well, but you're alive and she's not. You're living in her house and you're doing pretty well.
So far.
I don't know whether to, you know, you're a scientist and a businessman and very successful and came to Chapel Hill. And along about the same time as you retired, you've changed careers. You've done what you wanted to do, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been writing all along, but I began doing it full time at that point. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And written some great books that guide us in our visits to natural areas, walks in the natural areas of North Carolina and South Carolina. And of course, the famous book that was the first book ever broadcast during my responsibility on North Carolina Book Watch, Islands of Hope, which was a wonderful, beautiful description of nature preserves and the conflict that goes on in the management of nature museums and the man's interaction with.
I remember well the Book Watch program.
You do.
Because I went out there to the TV station, and there were two names on the list of people that were going to be doing interviews with you that day. The second name kind of outshone mine a little bit.
I cannot imagine who
his name happened to be. Dean Smith.
Oh.
And so I'm sure everybody remembers his interview, and they may not remember mine as well.
Well, two great Chapel Hill people to help me, who were kind enough to help me get started on that program. Well, I've got you out here to talk about projects that you're involved in. Let's first of all mention that one of the things that you do is every Monday you send out to anybody who would like to receive it a sort of short summary of the books that have come to your attention that have to do with science writing for the popular audience.
Right.
And it's not like it's
books.
One or two. It's usually five or six or sometimes
at least
eight or ten
three or
books.
Four. Right now it's a lot of them because this is a very high-volume time for books. And so, yeah, mm-hmm. It's called Science Book News.
The thing that I called you to talk about is the book review that you did several months ago for the News and Observer on Walter Isaacson's book, A Biography of Albert Einstein. And so I'm in the middle. I can't say I'm in the middle of reading this book. I'm in the middle of listening to this book. And it's wonderful. And it raises the question about, to me, you know, about all kinds of things about Einstein, his scientific theories. But is the book, as you read it, more interesting as a description of the a layman's description of the science, or was Einstein just an interesting character, notwithstanding his science?
I hate to give you the stock answer, but both. I mean, it was really a very, very well done book, in my opinion. I thought Isaacson, who's not a scientist, handled the science very well. But the most, to me, I already knew most of the science. The Einstein as a person was absolutely fascinating. I knew a little bit about his life, but not quite as much as I probably should have. To most people, especially in the United States, Einstein's kind of this saintly man with this frizzy hair peering out with these kind of sad eyes and these black and white photos.
It's a caricature. You can't walk across the Carolina campus without seeing a T-shirt.
That's right.
Che Guevara or Albert Einstein. I mean, these are...
And if you go through the physics department, you'll see mostly Albert Einstein. And so you get this impression of this kind of saintly old gentleman. And that's, of course, the elder Einstein, the Einstein that came to the United States. That was not Einstein, young Einstein, at all. He was a bohemian. He played around with women. He was a very attractive man and a total anti-authoritarian guy. He was the ultimate outsider, and it was those characteristics that enabled him, in my opinion, or had a lot to do with the fact that he was able to overturn in physics some very, very long-standing concepts and ideas, namely the concepts of Newton on space and time.
Well, just talking about him personally, was he German? Was he Jewish? Was he Swiss? Or was he American? Or Italian? Where did he come from, and who was he?
Well, he was, of course, Jewish, although he was never, ever in his life, a very religious Jew. He spoke German. He ended up as a patent clerk in Switzerland, of course, spent much of his life in the United States. He considered himself a man of an international person. He was very much opposed to highly national governments, having fled Germany during the rise of Hitler in the 1930s. He was very aware of that. And interestingly enough, when in the 1950s, when the House of Un-American Activities Committee was pursuing scientists and literary people in the United States, scared Einstein to death. He thought it was going to be a repeat of what had happened in Germany with this rise of fascism and Nazism in the case of Germany. He was really worried about that, and he didn't understand, and Walter Isaacson made this point very well, that in a democracy things sometimes go too far, but then they correct, and then they go back the other way. Einstein was not at all familiar with that, and it frightened him to see what was going on. And, of course, fortunately for all of us, it did get corrected, and we went back to a more normal society.
Well, tell us about Einstein's origins. The name Ulm comes to my mind, a little town in Germany, but can you tell us about his parents and about the time in which into which he was born? Those of us who are interested in history know that the time that Einstein was being, was born in the 1880s, I guess, sometime.
This 1879.
Was 1879.
Yeah.
This was a time of transition in Europe and in Germany as well, as Germany was learning how to be a united country. That it was excelling in academia, but at the same time threatening already to be a militaristic country. It was all conflicts, but how did Einstein and his family fit into that these were Jews in Germany at that time. How did Jews in Germany fit in?
One of the things they did was they moved to Munich, which was a little less militaristic than other parts of Germany. But basically, I mean, Einstein and his family both, all of them, to a large extent, tried to stay separate from this. They were not part of this machine at all. And Einstein in particular just rebelled against it completely and would have nothing to do with it. His parents, as far as I know, and I'm virtually certain this is true, were pretty much the same way. They were not... they were not these highly nationalistic people. There have been scientists, very famous scientists during that period that were. Fritz Haber, who was a friend of Einstein's, who invented the process, called making bread from the air, which was a process for fixing nitrogen, which is how we make everything now, make fertilizers. Fritz Haber wanted to be a German. He was Jewish, but he wanted so bad to be a German, he did everything he could do to be more German than the next guy, including being the first person to use weapons of mass destruction, so to speak, which in this case was chlorine gas during World War I for the Germans. But no matter how Germanic he tried to become, when Hitler finally took power, Haber's Jewish roots came to the fore, and he was thrown out of Germany.
Well, I want to move in focusing on the early times. Something that caught my attention, I don't know whether it caught your attention, was that Einstein's father and his uncle were involved in a business that sounds commonplace to us, the electricity business. They were engineers, but in the 1880s and 90s, there weren't any electricity here on most of the farms that my ancestors grew up on. I mean, that was a new business. They were They were, how do you say it? They were leaders, weren't they, in the electrification?
Not technically speaking, no.
Yeah, but they were.
But in
they
terms
were spread,
of their business,
the
yeah. They were trying to set up a small electrical generating business.
Well, you won't just go where I want you to go. But, I mean, here's the thing that struck me. The Einstein family was responsible for the first electrification of Oktoberfest in Munich. Now, you think of something that is so classically German. That is a big deal. And they electrified Schwabing, which is the close-in suburb, sort of the nightlife suburb. So they were, Mr. Dukes, the Duke Power of the Carolinas.
Well, the reason I don't want to go there is, first of all, I'm not sure that's right. I know that his family was in. They never were like Westinghouse. They never were like Thomas Edison. They were small businessmen, and they did. I think, and I could be wrong, but I don't believe I am. They were focusing on direct current electricity, which is what Edison was doing. And of course, they were supplanted very early on in the 20th century by Nikola Tesla's work that with alternating current. I mean, if you go to Niagara Falls, which I just happened to do, you'll find this huge statue of Nikola Tesla, who many people haven't even heard of, and because of this astounding feat. And I think it was 1905 in Buffalo.
Let's take a break. But, I mean, you're teaching me stuff that I thought Europe was still doing direct current, but they're not. They're doing alternating current.
No. Everybody's right. No, there is no direct current left.
All right. Well, Philip Manning is my science advisor, and sometimes he has to advise me on the air. He and I are talking about Walter Isaacson's book, a biography of Albert Einstein, and we're going to be talking about a few other science topics as well. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. Philip Manning and I are talking about Walter Isaacson's book on Albert Einstein, and I got I'm mistaken as usual about direct and indirect and alternating current and different cycles. And during the break, Philip Manning quietly brought me up to date, and sure enough, they do have alternating current in Europe, just a different cycles. So my point, though, is that these guys were the parents and the family of Albert Einstein. It wasn't like he arose from a family of merchants or peddlers, as you might think the wealth of Jews in Germany might be created, or bankers. These guys were engineers who were thinking as a business people in scientific terms. And so he had a little bounce, didn't he, from his family?
From an engineering point of view, yes, he did. I mean, but his family was not of a scientific bent, not the way anything, of course, like the way Einstein was, as well, of course.
Well,
most
now
of us
look,
aren't.
That's easy to say, because he would almost never be able to say that somebody was like Einstein in terms of their scientific background. So,
yeah, in fact, Isaacson.
Give me the benefit of saying this was. He had a family background that gave him a better background than 99% of the people
That's
in Germany.
That part, I would agree with that, yes.
All right. Whew. Now tell us some more about Einstein.
Okay. Well, one of the interesting things you just said was, and of course we've all heard it said, you're no Einstein. and Isaacson, in fact, uses that term once in the biography, in which he's talking about the ability to visualize warped space-time. And Isaacson says, of course, most of us have a little problem visualizing this warped space-time, which is four-dimensional. He says that, of course, we're no Einsteins, and he's right.
Well, that's interesting that you bring it up, and I'm trying to push you back into Einstein's earlier life. And Isaacson suggests, doesn't he, that one of the things that gave Einstein strength over other scientists who were trying to deal with these concepts is that he had a superior ability to visualize. to visualize this thing. I cannot visualize a four-dimensional curved space. I mean, it's never going to happen. And as some scientist had that, I can't visualize it either.
I don't think anybody can. Maybe not even Einstein.
There's a theory in there about that Einstein's early problems with developing speech might have had something to do with that.
That's possible, and it is true. Einstein had a most unusual approach to science, more different from any scientist that I've ever known, and which was many scientists think you get certain data, experimental data, and you think, well, okay, I'll put together a theory to explain all this data. That was not Einstein's approach. Einstein said, how should the universe work? And in his best work, his very best work, he would say, this is the way the universe ought to work. Now, here's a couple of experiments that you guys can go out and check to see if it really works that way. He always included this. I mean, it was really amazing.
Suggesting ways to confirm or to refute his proposals.
That's right. And one of the probably the biggest and best, most important day of his life was when he proposed in 1915 the general theory of relativity, which is certainly has to be the greatest scientific breakthrough ever in the history of science. I mean, it was so unbelievable what he did. And he, at the end of his paper, Einstein said, oh, by the way, this should cause stars to bend light a certain amount. And so
the idea that gravity would have an effect not just on matter but on light.
Because in Einstein's theory, of course, it's not gravity, it's a warping of space-time. So whatever goes through space-time, light, matter, whatever, will go in the direction that Einstein's general theory said it should. And so I think it was 4 years after he proposed it. Of course, you can't see light bending around the sun because the sun's too bright. So what do? You wait for a full eclipse, a full eclipse of the sun, which is what they did. And they sent astronomers to at least three or four different locations to measure. When the sun was black, they could measure what happened to the light from stars. And they measured and they calculated the bending of light. It was exactly as predicted by Einstein. And Isaacson points out that, you know, we make a big deal. It was a huge deal. But when they asked Einstein about it, they said, you know, he said he was totally unimpressed by the fact that they had proven his theory. He said, I knew the theory was correct. I knew it was correct. Now, that is something that you don't hear from the words scientists say very often. We'll hedge. I mean, well, it sounds like it's true. It's a hypothesis. It hasn't been disproved. Blah, blah, blah. Einstein says, I knew it was correct. That's great.
That's great kind of confidence. I want you, again, I keep pushing you back because the early stages of Einstein's life and career, to me, are just as interesting as some of these magnificent achievements in the sense that at not every stage in his career could you have predicted that he was going to be a Nobel Prize winning kind of cult hero. He couldn't get a job.
He couldn't get a job. Most people, I think, in those days recognized his intellectual genius. Now, whether they said, oh, this is going to be the greatest scientist in the history of the world, probably not. But he was never considered to be anything but smart, although you hear rumors to the other effect. The problem was he was really quite a rebel. And, you know, if somebody said something he didn't like, he wouldn't go to class. If they made a mistake, he would not hesitate to correct them.
He'd pick fights with his professors.
Or ignore them.
And act like the smart aleck. Like we see, you know, like all of us saw in our classes, the very smartest guys kind of got a edge to them that a teacher, understandably, would not necessarily write a great recommendation for him.
Yeah, a lot of us have been smart alecks, but none of us have been smart alecks like Einstein.
smart aleck as Einstein. That's true. But here's the thing that made this tough for me to understand that with faculty members that I know today, and of course they're not the same as they were 100 years ago, but they do resent students who are impertinent, who just jump on them and who are rude and who don't cooperate, they do resent it. But when they see one who is really brilliant, they just can't resist giving that moving that person along and finding opportunities for that. And it seemed like in Einstein's case that some of his professors, at least one or two of them, just said, "This guy challenged me. We'll teach him a lesson."
And keep in mind, of course, this was primarily in Germany around 1900. This was not the most tolerant.
So this anti-Semitism might have been a piece of
this. No, I don't think it was anti-Semitism. It might have been, but I think it was just the hierarchical nature.
You cooperate, you obey your leader, you follow the rules, right. and things will go right for you. But if you're a rebel, smart as you might be, you're not getting any help from me.
That's right. It was a very conformist society to some extent, you still see that in certain parts of Germany. I mean, I know I went through Austria a few years back, and it was like every house had a flower pot on the front of the house. I mean, it's like, did they have a law that say you had to do it, or did just everybody just do it, or I don't know, you know? But it was.
I walked by your house the other day. There was a flower pot there.
Well, I'm not Austrian. Anyway, it was then. I'm pretty sure this is true. That we're a very hierarchical society. Things you didn't challenge very often. If you did, you usually got in trouble. And that's what happened to Einstein, because he was ready to challenge anybody about anything at any time.
Going to take a quick break. I'm talking to Chapel Hill-based science writer Philip Manning about Walter Isaacson's biography of Albert Einstein. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Chapel Hill-based science writer Philip Manning about Walter Isaacson's book about Albert Einstein. And Phil Manning is the expert. He wrote a review for the News Observer on the book and clearly loves the book and is a great admirer of Albert Einstein. Now, I've been pushing you. You teased me during the break that I've been pushing you to talk about the early part of the book because that's where I am. So you're unleashed. What's important about Einstein today, scientifically, in terms of what his life might have meant outside of his science? Why is this an important life to get a fine biography, as Mr. Isaacson gave it?
Well, Isaacson is not a scientist, as I mentioned earlier, but Einstein was a rebel. He was an interesting character, but he would not be having biographies written about him if it were not for some of his magnificent achievements, which puts him probably as one of the two or three best, greatest scientists of all time, right up there with Isaac Newton and Maxwell. I mean, he is really, really great. I'll give you one example that I thought was just astounding. It had to do with an effect called the photoelectric effect. You shine a light and hit a metal, and if the light is a certain wavelength, it ejects an electron. Okay, well, that makes light sound like it's a particle. It's hitting in the air and it's imparting energy to an electron. Electron flies out in the air. But if you take light, Einstein, by the way, was the one who explained this effect as light quanta, as he would call them, hitting a photon, hitting a metal. Einstein said the reason these electrons got ejected is because light has photons. These photons are hitting them, imparting energy to the electrons, and there they go. And this is one of the great papers of all time. But that's only the beginning. There are many, many experiments done 100 years before that that show that light cannot be a light particle. It has to be a wave because it gives this diffraction pattern that only waves give. I mean, particles don't give diffraction patterns, so light clearly has to be a wave. Well, what is it? And that's where Einstein, it took him several years of grappling with this after he showed that the photoelectric effect proved that light was a particle, that light was could be either particle or a wave. That's a very, very difficult concept and one of the key elements of quantum mechanics.
Well, here's a question that I got for you. And since you've read the later part of the book, you can maybe answer it for me. Or if you can't, fake it, because I will never know whether. But did Einstein basically just do a bunch of experiments to find these things out, or did he come at it some other way? And if he did it by experimentation, how could he, as kind of an individual guy, you know, working in first in a patent office without a lot of scientific equipment, how did he do the scientific experiments to back up all this
stuff? He didn't do any experiments. Einstein never did any experiences. I mean, within no meaningful experiments in his whole life did he. He never did them. As I mentioned before, what he did was he thought how this world should work. And he wrote down, he said, this is the way the world should work. Now, guys, I'm going to give you a few things. You can go out and check it out and make sure that I'm right. And they did. And now the case of the photoelectric effect is a little different. He did have the data when he started. He knew that there was this photoelectric effect, that is to say, that you were ejecting electrons. But why? How? How could all these things happen? Can you show that there was any reason for that to happen? Einstein did show that. He made a few predictions based on that as well, and of course they turned out to be
correct. Is it fair to say this, that he primarily operated by explaining the unexplained effects of other people's scientific observations and experiments?
It's part of it. That's not the whole story.
Right. What's the rest of it?
The way he worked is really unbelievable and different from any scientist that I've seen or heard of. Einstein, especially particularly in concerning the general theory of relativity, his masterpiece, this was his crown jewel. He didn't have any experimental data. He didn't care about experimental data. He thought, how should the universe work? How should it work? How is it put together? And if it is put together that way, what does it mean? And that's how he came up with the general theory of relativity. He had no data. He didn't need any data. He was Einstein. I mean, that's a fantastic situation, what he did.
I guess most of us walk around this world knowing that Einstein's explanations and achievements are very important to us today, but we have no, if you pressed us to explain just fundamentally what it's all about, we probably couldn't get started. And so I wonder if Walter Isaacson, in his biography of Albert Einstein, is it worth reading the biography because Isaacson will explain that to us so we can understand it and repeat it to others?
Absolutely. It's a wonderful non-scientific explanation of science. I mean,
would
he does a really
then,
good job with it.
Would you try it to just explain it to us?
Well, there's several things. I mean, in 1905, Einstein published three papers that either any one of which would have revolutionized science, one of which was the photoelectric effect. Think about it. Light can be both wave and particle. This is something that's totally foreign.
I love this, and I wanted you to do this, but let me stick with it. Can you make me begin even to understand the general theory, the 1915 general theory of relativity? Can you do that? If you get a special prize.
I could do better with the special theory, but I'll give it a try. I understand it just to a large extent, but not perfectly myself. But I'll tell you what sort of the two paragraph synopsis would be.
Without using a single big word.
I don't use big words, except Isaac Newton. That's where it starts. Isaac Newton proposed the theory of gravity, which says that mass, two objects, are attracted to one another by in a relationship that concerns how much each one weighs or what the mass of each one is divided by the distance, the square of the distance between them. In his proposal, which was just about as revolutionary as Einstein's, or maybe more so, he said, you know, one of the problems is that if you got a mass and it's sitting over here in 1,000 miles away from what is there between them? I mean, how can one affect the other? And this is where Newton said, and he used the Latin term, which I forgot, but basically he said, I propose no hypothesis. I don't know. I don't know how gravity works, is what he said.
His great contribution was explaining that it did work and how it worked without explaining the reasons, the surrounding, you know, what it was that was doing gravity.
How it could work.
He just said gravity's there and you can measure it, and here's some associations, but I don't know why it works that way.
I'm going to tell you where the moon can be tomorrow night, and I'm going to tell you exactly where it's and it was. I'll tell you where Mars is going to be the next night, and there it was.
Okay, so there's where we are now. And what does Einstein do to all that?
Einstein said, that how can there be action at a distance, is what it was called. How can this body know that there's another body sitting over here? What is there between them to tell them that? And the answer turned out to be, there's nothing between them except space. But that space is warped, is changed by the matter. I think it goes something like, you could say, matter warps space, and matter changes space, and space, and it follows. Now, I'm not saying it quite right. It's a saying about, anyway, that matter warps space, and then matter follows that warp space.
Does warp, when you say warp, that means bend.
Bend. Now, when I say space here, I'm not talking about regular three-dimensional. I'm talking about space-time. I should have been more clear. So it warps space-time, and therefore, when the moon goes around the Earth, okay, instead of saying, well, there's some kind of tether between
right,
them.
Right.
Like Newton would have proposed. What Einstein says is, no, wait a minute, space is warped. And so all the moon is doing is traveling in what it thinks is a straight line. But space is warped there, so it's actually traveling in an ellipse around
right,
the
well,
Earth.
That's a good starting point. I don't understand, but,
all right,
but I'll just stay there. Or can you?
I can give you one.
I mean, I understand that I don't understand, but I kind of begin to see.
Let me give you a two-dimensional analog.
All right.
Take a trampoline, put a cannonball in the middle of it, and then throw a smaller ball, and it'll go around in a circle. You've warped that surface by putting that cannonball there. Well, matter warps space-time in a similar way. All you got to do is scale that up from two dimensions to four dimensions, and boom, you got it.
I'm going to take a break and think about it. Talking to Phil Manning, who's talking about Albert Einstein, based on Walter Isaacson's fairly new biography of Albert Einstein. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to we've just got a few more minutes, so I'm going to ask Phil Manning to talk about a few other matters of popular science interest. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. Phil Manning, the Chapel Hill-based science writer, agreed to come out and talk to me about Albert Einstein. I noticed that Philip Manning had written a review of the new biography by Walter Isaacson. And we could talk about Einstein for a long time, but and we'll never finish. But we are finished for today because I've got you. I want to grab you about some other sort of current science topics. I saw on Bill Friday's show on UNCTV the other day a wonderful interview with a professor from North Carolina State about genetic mapping and about all of the lightning-paced progress that seems to be made in terms of being able to map to identify every gene in the human body. And then you say, well, what good does it do us? And they say, well, it doesn't do us any good because we've identified the genes. We can see them. We will be able to do wonderful things in the future. But right now, we're just trying to find out what each, we've got the genes, but we don't know exactly what they do. Is this a subject of popular scientific writing now?
It is. And there's been a lot written about it. And I think I might disagree with
this is my impression, and I'm sure that
I'll give you an example of and there's many, many things, but one example that really struck me is what's called a SNP, a single nucleotide, when you got one small change in a gene. And forever, people have had this really dread disease called Huntington's disease. And it's only recently that they have found the gene that causes it. Not recently, but in the past, say, 20, 30 years, they found the gene that causes it. And what it is, remember A, C, G, and T, these are the bases in DNA. And so if you've got a certain sequence of A, C, G, and T, and I'm not sure what it is, but it repeats itself over, and if it repeats itself 50 times, you have Huntington's disease. If it repeats itself 70 times, you got Huntington's disease at an earlier age. If you've got 30 repeats, you don't get Huntington's. We can't do anything about that right now. I mean, nobody knows how to manipulate those genes, but certainly the first step in approaching that disease has got to be understanding that that is the source of it. And that's some of the things that they're learning. They've learned many, many others genetic diseases. And so far, maybe no cures, but that's the way you got to go.
Well, you think, I mean, and you properly scolded me for reading, I think, too much into the evaluation of what we could do right now in terms of taking advantage of the genetic map of the human genes, which only, you know, it's almost like yesterday that we had that. And so it's unfair to expect that it miraculously turns everything around, but that the potential, because the scientists do see what they can do, what the possibilities that are opened up. And with scientists all over the world working on this, I mean, they could keep you busy writing every day as some scientist comes up with some way to do this. I mean, we're going to be living in a time of revolution, aren't we? If we stay alive, if one of these genetic diseases doesn't
No, absolutely. That's absolutely right. I mean, it all started when we finally understood the structure of DNA. That was in 1954, over 50 years ago. So, I mean, it seems like a long time, but actually in terms of how long human beings have been on this earth, we've just barely learned about it. So scientists are working as hard as they can. I have no doubt, none whatsoever, that many, many great medicines and solutions to problems will come from this work.
Well, you've told us that one of the great books within the last year is Walter Isaacson's Einstein. Now, you used to compile a list every year of the great science books. If you were doing that, or if you are going to do that, other than Isaacson's books, in the last 12 months, what other books would you say, guy, you know, if you got time, read this. It'll help you understand something that's real important.
You know, one of the interesting books, and this is not a very well-known book, it's put out by Joseph Henry Press, which is an arm of the National Academy of Science. But it's a book, and it's called GRID. And what it is, talking about how Einstein and his electrical family, it's about how all these grids in the United States are connected. For example, you might recall, I think it was a few years back, what happened was they had a hot day in Ohio. The transmission lines got so much overuse, they got heated up. They sagged a little bit. They touched a tree and shorted out. And through a series of basically operator errors, the whole Northeast was shut down. People were stranded in elevators in New York City, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it was terrible. And so the question is, I mean, the grid works so great most of the time, but why have a grid anyway? I mean, you know, why doesn't each municipality just generate their own power and let it go at that? And this guy gets into this kind of question, and the answer is very obvious. I mean, you take AC power. You can't store it. I mean, you know. So if you got a circuit with only two light bulbs, you cut one off, all of a sudden you got too much power. Or you cut an extra one on, you don't have enough power. If you got hundreds of millions of light bulbs, as you do in a grid, you cut one off and it makes no difference at all. So this is mostly an averaging out effect that enables you to supply the right amount of electricity at the right time. That's why you have a grid. And that was really interesting to me because you can see the frailties of it.
The grid is the cooperative ability, the interconnectedness of all the transmission and the generating plants, so that throughout the country, most of them are connected in some form or fashion in a way that's probably imperfect. It wasn't designed. They're just sort of series of patchworks to put together. And so they don't always operate exactly perfectly. They subjected to some risk that something like you pointed out in Ohio might shut down the power here in North Carolina.
It's possible. Most of they are major grids, the Northeastern being one grid, but that's a huge grid. It goes from Cleveland to New York and so forth. But that's basically, I mean, 10,000 power plants in the United States. And all of them are connected in some way, shape, or form. And that's the reason, because without a grid, you can't generate the right amount of electricity.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Are you arguing that's a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a really good thing, in my opinion. I mean, it's a better thing if you've got a good grid, which we happen to have in this country. Other countries do not have quite as reliable a grid. Like, for example, Baghdad, I mean, the grid there is in trouble. But in this country, we have an excellent grid. It's up. I mean, it's so good that we never even think about it. You get up in the morning, you cut on your coffee, you don't expect it to not work. You know it's going to work because we have a good grid. And so to that extent, it's great, yes.
Well, is there anybody, gosh, we just got a minute, less than a minute, anybody in the popular scientific writing community who is like a Rachel Carson or somebody who's moving our collective views about the world and how it operates in that fashion, or are there just a bunch of fairly good ones out there?
There's some great ones. There really are. There's a new book just out by Steven Pinker, who's a Harvard professor of neuroscience. And this guy has written two or three other books, and I've read them. I have not read his newest one yet. But he is changing the way we think about our minds. In my opinion, he is. And one of the most fantastic things he said was when, in the end of one of his books, he was asking these sort of overarching questions. Why are we here on Earth? What is the purpose of life?
Because we're, get to the great question, we're done. My guest has been Philip Manning, a Chapel Hill Science writer. Thanks for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.